We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the five-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. When you have a minute, check out Muse at choosemuse.com. It's an amazing tool to help you begin or deepen your meditation practice. And there are several new features designed to help you sleep more peacefully. Today's guest is Taylor White Moffett. Taylor is this extraordinary blend of psychotherapist, yoga and mindfulness teacher, and leadership facilitator. She's also funny and refers to her energy as sometimes feeling like a fire hose. I think she's a fountain of wisdom. Her year-long program is called Humanity First and is designed to teach us how to be better leaders at work and at home and to know ourselves and others more deeply. She shares how she sees the potential in all of us as whole beings to be radically honest with ourselves and to communicate with more compassion and understanding. Her work invites you to shed your insecurities and open your heart so you can be seen and heard by your own self and others. She invites her students and clients to risk being courageous, leading us into our greatness with the peace, ease, and freedom we all want and deserve. She's also a teacher on Muse and Meditation Studio, so you may want to check out her meditations. Now, here's Taylor. Taylor, I have a big smile on my face. I'm so excited to have you on Untangle today.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. I always appreciate you and I having a chance to have conversation because I know one thing it will be, which is rich.
Whenever we have conversations, we tend to go off in a million different directions. So let's see how we do with that here. I want to give our listeners a little bit of texture about who you are in case they don't know you or maybe haven't heard your meditations on Muse or Meditation Studio. Tell us a little bit about how you came to be a therapist and how you integrate different modalities into your practice and into the work that you do.
So my first experience with psychotherapy was being a teenager. My parents got divorced and they did what I think a lot of parents do, which is they dragged me right away to a therapist. And I saw this 60-something-year-old white man who didn't have children. And I remember thinking about 15 minutes into this appointment, and I was 12, I thought, this guy's terrible. I think I could do this better than him and have compassion and curiosity about the person in front of me. And it was one of the first times looking back that I began to realize that I think there was a spiritual person from the beginning of time. I just didn't know it. I was the stirrer of the pot of my family. And I always asked questions. I was curious about why so-and-so was always drinking at a family event, why so-and-so was getting a divorce, why wasn't anyone talking about such and such? And I had a great curiosity about human behavior, including my own. And at some point that turned, and I would say my experience was to survive my family of origin and to survive where I grew up in New England. I very much learned that the message I was getting from people was that I was too much and that I needed to be less, to be smaller. And so what I did was I got really small and I got quiet, but I got small. And then fast forward to I'm about early 20s and I've moved to Boulder. I really don't know why. I'm thinking I'm here for winter and I'm out for a run in an alleyway and there's nothing to trip over. But all of a sudden I found myself on my knees and I just heard this, I don't know, I guess a voice. I've never heard anything like it again, that just said, you can't go on like this. And it was another marking point for me that it was time to change my life. And so right around that time, two things happened. One, I became really aware of how I kept trying to be smaller and make sure I wasn't too much in anyone's eyes and that that needed to stop. And that the second was I felt really called to listen to my heart and not my head. At that moment, I was actually scheduled to start thinking about taking prereqs to go to medical school to be a psychiatrist. That was what everyone had recommended to me. And I really didn't want to do it. And it was the moment I realized I'm not being who I really am. I'm not doing what I really want to do. And so I right away, luckily listened to that and changed course and headed off to graduate school at UVM and never looked back.
What did you make of when you heard this voice in your 20s? And then I want to go back to something you said about your family of origin. But when you heard this voice, what did you make of it? Did you think it was your intuition? Did you feel it was coming from a spiritual place? Was it like a still silent voice within? What was your interpretation at the time that had such a big influence on your actions?
At that point, I really honestly had no idea. It was a little bit scary. Like I looked around like, okay, there's no one around me talking. And I like was like, no one shoved me to the ground. There was no stump or rock I tripped over. So at first it was like, how am I on my knees hearing this? And then there was just, I don't know any other word to say, but just this very calm knowing of don't try to figure it out. Just feel it and listen to it. And that's really why for me, that was the big shift of I had really shut myself down and spent a lot of time trying to figure things out and to get it right, just a lot of trying. And in that moment, it was just, can you feel this and can you trust it? And I really don't know why, but I did. And I just began to turn. Now, I don't want any of the listeners to think I then became, I jumped in the spiritual bandwagon. Right. It was great. It was a long, slow turn of my ocean liner, but it was probably one of the most marked moments I recall of, I am on the wrong path. I'm in the wrong place. And I actually deep within me know who I am and where I need to be. And I don't want to miss that opportunity. And I want to start living into that.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing that that happened for you. When you say, because I feel a little bit about this too, that you spent a lot of time trying to survive your family of origin. When you first began that process, was it so much in your head, like really trying to understand why you felt a certain way, why your parents behaved a certain way, like answering questions logically, trying to fix things? Was that your process when you say surviving using your?
I have a belief that each of our personalities are the costumes we develop to survive childhood. So in my family, I had very smart, funny, quick, know-it-all people in my family, both my family of origin and my extended family. And so it felt like the unspoken rule was to have all the answers, know what's going on, but don't speak up too much. It felt a lot like as an adult now, I would say the box of being a woman, right? Like be fit, but don't be too fit, be smart, but too smart. There's really nowhere to rest comfortably. And so I don't think as a young person, I spent time trying to figure it out. I think what I learned is I really wanted to be loved and to belong. So I learned really quickly, okay, this is who I need to be to get that. Then over time, I would have little fissure cracks open up and little windows into, I'm still wondering why this person is doing this or why this is happening for me. And then I would just kind of squelch that crack or fissure and go back to my old ways. And then over time, I think that fall in the alley, that bringing me to my knees in the alley really just opened up that that was using all my energy. It was putting myself off in the wrong direction to do the wrong things. And I wanted something so much more. And it was already there in me. I just had to get courageous enough to listen and trust it.
Yeah, it makes sense that on your website, when you're describing your work as a therapist, you say therapy asks you to dig deep and be radically honest with yourself and others. The process asks that you give yourself tremendous self-compassion for wherever you are while conjuring up all the courage you can for where you're going. And it sounds like exactly what you did for yourself.
Yes, I have to believe this is true for most of us, Patricia, and I don't know, but I think sometimes people look at, for example, therapists or mindfulness instructors or leadership facilitators, and they have these stories like they have it all figured out. They have it together. They have all this wisdom to share. And although I believe we all have wisdom to share, what I find the most impactful that I share with people in all the settings I work in is what's worked for me, because that's the thing I have the most experience around. And that doesn't mean it'll work for everyone. It doesn't mean it's quote unquote right. And at the same time, I think if our knowledge comes from a book and our head, it's really incomplete. And for me, that was the biggest transition into becoming who I really was as a young adult, which was becoming my integrated, wholehearted self rather than my very cognitive, heavy self.
Yeah. The first therapist your parents selected for you, the man, was not an integrated, wholehearted human being at the time.
Thank goodness he gave me a great call to action. I don't know otherwise if I even knew what therapists were at that point in time.
And it's a good point. When something happens that doesn't feel right, it can be a teacher as much as when something does feel right. So that was a gift.
Absolutely.
Why did you begin to integrate mindfulness and yoga into your therapy practice? And do you do that? Or is it more philosophically, it's all one for you?
Philosophically, it's one, but in the daily experience, it's not. I think people, unless they feel their personal expression verbally and their spiritual practice and their body are aligned, I think most people would feel initially, they would say like, oh, I'm not used to breathing with a therapist. I'm not used to lying on the floor with my legs up the wall with a therapist. I'm not used to my yoga teacher also being my therapist. And so I was trained very traditionally, psychodynamically as a therapist, where in my world, we call it the peas and carrots don't touch. I'm supposed to share nothing about me and we're supposed to develop a relationship. And I think what happened for me was after almost a decade, I both had been a yogi for a decade and had been a therapist for a decade and was like, these two worlds are the same worlds. The mind and body aren't connected. They are the same. The cells of our mind are all through our body and vice versa. And we keep talking about them like they're separate entities that have somehow been sewn together. And if I'm going to have a relationship with people, I know how to have impeccable truth and hold myself and hold other people. So I think the peas and carrots need to start touching. I met with a really beautiful therapist here in Boulder, Ellen Bader, and we met in the back of a coffee shop. I'll never forget. And we were whispering. It was as though we thought someone was going to jump us and get us. And I said, have you been breathing with anyone in your office? And she said, I have. Have you? And we didn't want to tell anybody because at the time it was so taboo that therapists would have, oh my God, touched people in a yoga class would have been just over the top. But to just even have people breathe or put their hands on their body or to be aware was just so different. And I was having such a profound experience as a decade-long yogi. I thought, there's no way, yet again, I can't share what's been so helpful for me.
Yeah. And I know in your yoga classes, which I took pre-COVID, you always weave in life messages, but I always leave your classes feeling like I've been in a therapy session.
Yeah. I think, again, what's interesting is when people are on retreat with me, we call our retreats transformational. I absolutely stand by that. And to me, people will sometimes say, I didn't know there was going to be group therapy. And I say, what I try to remind my students the first days of retreat and often in my office and sometimes in a weekly asana class is that yoga is an 8-limb process. And the first two limbs ask us to be radically truthful with ourselves and with the rest of the world. And that's really what my retreats entail is we are definitely going to move and do yoga asana. And we're also going to do meditation. And we're also going to notice our breath. And we're going to hold periods of silence. And we're going to journal. We're going to integrate all 8 limbs of yoga in that week. And most people are so not used to sharing their real stuff with anyone that they feel most comfortable, I think, naming it group therapy or therapy. And I think I just call it human talk. I try to give a Dharma talk at the beginning of each of my yoga classes. And again, it's not a spiritual text of like this yama, or it's not a reference from a book. It's like, I was driving over here and I saw 3 homeless people and it got me thinking about this. I want everything I offer to be approachable and real life, because although there's wonderful stories that we know in the Bhagavad Gita and so many spiritual and yogic texts, I find that I could meditate on the goddess Lakshmi all day, but that's not going to help me when I leave the yoga class and in the parking lot, somebody almost runs me over because they're in a hurry.
Yeah.
So I want to give people practical, real experiences in their meditation, in their psychotherapy, in their retreats as leaders, because I want us to be accessible to ourselves and to one another. and to really just call that being human.
It is being human. And I like the words you used, integrated and transformational, because that's so much about your practice, making someone integrate all the different parts of themselves and feel comfortable with that, with the ultimate goal of transformation.
It says a lot.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping, available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. I was curious when you first launched, I guess it was 2 years ago, your Humanity First program. And I'd love for you to share a little bit about that, because you're then bringing in all of your wisdom from therapy, yoga, mindfulness, social activism into this very rich year-long program that combines mindfulness, awareness, breathing, business skills. Will you tell us a little bit about this program?
Yeah, I'd love to. So in the fall of 2019, I had a student come to me and say, "Look, Taylor, I think of you as someone of your word, and you keep telling me you're going to offer a teacher training and you're not doing it. Would you please do it?" And I was like, "Shoot, okay, I guess I better do it." So I got my work wife and we went to Aspen and we went for the weekend, and I brought these huge pads of sticky post-its I love, and we covered the whole wall. And I just about went into a panic attack of like, what am I possibly going to teach and offer? And what came out over the next 2 days was just what we're talking about, which is everything that has saved me, healed me, helped me repair difficult relationships, and helped me thrive as a human came into this training. And so I quickly realized this was not going to be a yoga teacher training. This was really about how to be fully human. And I named the training Humanity First, the art and practice of being fully human, because at the time I was coming off of 3 or 4 years of teaching another class I created called the Art and Practice of Self-Compassion. And I just began to realize that we feel shame to identify as a perfectionist. We feel shame to identify with our family of origin or part of our childhood. We feel a tremendous amount of shame, self-recrimination, and judgment. And we bring whoever we are everywhere. And so what I started to see is people who were working so hard to beautifully lead in their homes as a parent, in their neighborhood, on their nonprofit board, in their Fortune 500 company, and yet they were stuck in their heads and they couldn't figure out the journey of how to lead beautifully from their head. And so this training became an expression of almost 5 decades of my life, of the journey from head to heart and how to integrate an embodied life and bring that into your leadership. And I think if you know me a little bit, you know I'm often very late to the party. My kids tease me that I'm 10 years behind with music. So I actually trained with Brené Brown more than a decade ago before anyone knew who Brené Brown was. And it had a really big impact on me around vulnerability and exposure. And that what's really was interesting to me is, similarly to myself, Brené has really landed herself or placed herself intentionally in the leadership work world. And it's something that I feel so impassioned about, because I say to my leaders in training, you are always leading, whether you know it or not. We are watching each other as humans as to how to behave. And currently it's April 2022. And just in the last, let's say, few months, we've seen the Will Smith, Chris Rock thing happen at the Oscars. We've got a war in the Ukraine. We are watching people in our homes, in our neighborhoods, celebrities, countries. We're watching how people behave. And we do this all the time. It's how we understand one another. And it's how we understand ourselves. But if it's not heart-centered, then it's all theoretical. And we don't have robots, most of us, working in our offices. We don't live with robots. We are still fully, thankfully, fully embodied humans. And the more we have the skill to drop into our body, to regulate our nervous systems, we have the ability to show up and be an example rather than a warning.
And then back to that question, and I know you're saying we bring all of who we are to work, but what role do emotions or feelings have in the workplace? I know I've talked to some people that lead companies that say they've tried certain programs and nobody's really interested in doing it, or they do it and then they continue on in their behaviors from before. And other people, depending on the leader, actually do really great. And the leader continues to enforce some of these things. So I'm curious, what role do emotions play in the workplace and how do we navigate that?
So when I say we bring all of who we are to work, it doesn't mean we express all of who we are, but for example, let's say I got a cancer diagnosis Friday and I go to work on Monday. I may not work in a setting that I feel permission, invitation, or encouragement to share that. So it's still with me and it's showing up everywhere. It's on my face, it's in my body, it's in how I'm able to process and what speed I'm processing at. It's how checked out I am. It's how self-aggressive I am. It's how I'm shutting it down or feeling it, right? So it's still in me somewhere. And it's on some level, I'm probably leading with it, depending on how difficult that diagnosis was. But if I don't have the permission, invitation, or skill to share it at work, it's going to leak out. And I don't tend to like things that leak. I tend to like things that are more intentional. So I could use an example, a woman who just graduated last week, actually, my most recent leadership training. She's a creative internationally for Coca-Cola. And when she went to her company for the first time, she just took this job about 2 months ago, and she set up a meeting to meet about 100 people that she was going to be supervising and working with. And she said, I sent an email before we met to share some of the struggles in my world and to say that what I had learned in this training of Humanity First and what I was intending to bring to my work in Coca-Cola was a practice of how do we hold ourselves so that we can hold others at work. And she said what she went on to explain was what she learned that meant for her was, she gave the example of having a very difficult health diagnosis, and that she said, that's mine to manage. I don't want to share so much that you all are worried about me, worried that I can do my job, so worried about me as a human, you can't function. But I need to share enough that tells you what my body's telling you without words, so that we can get things done and relate to each other as humans. And I think those are the two balancing poles, hiking poles, if you will, that I would like to see in all leadership, especially professional organizations, is that we share enough to relate and connect and see each other as humans. And we still move the ball forward because we need to get things done.
It's a slippery slope in a way. And I like what you're saying about it leaking out. When we had our training at Muse, our teacher was telling us about the process of being above or below the line. And as a leader, if you're below the line, which means you're just not feeling up to par, your stress levels are high, you may not react as you would choose, you may select to opt out of a conversation with something that you know is going to frustrate you. And if you're above the line, you're like, bring it on. Understanding how not to let something leak out, how to share it. I'm a little bit confused about that part. Like if you are really feeling frustrated, or you've just been diagnosed with something, or you're dealing with grief at home, or maybe a divorce or death in the family. How do you deal with that at work?
So that's really a lot of what the year-long leadership training is giving people a life practice and experiences to do that. Because I think of it, Patricia, like if you were to put your hand on the faucet, you have a skill in your body to open it slightly to where it's dripping, to open it more to a steady stream, to open it even more and to open it all the way up towards blasting or shut it off. And to me, managing your nervous system has the same idea. So I know this concept above and below the line, and to me, it's still in our heads. It's hard. What we're really talking about is nervous systems. And it's how when you walk in a room, if someone has their head on their hands, and there's no words coming out, your body responds. If someone has a huge smile and their arms open, your body responds. So we want to start understanding ourselves first. Where am I at? What's my rest level today? What's my nutrition level? What's my movement level? How am I doing? Let me check in with me first. Because if I have something going on right there, there's already probably a good sign that I don't want to go rushing to have a hard conversation with someone. So the training asks people to spend a year really getting to know themselves so that if they're going to have these hard conversations, they start with the skill of really checking in with self first and knowing what they need to simply add or subtract, to regulate, to pause, or go forward. And then part two is just an extension of that skill set, which is learning to have difficult conversations. And a lot of it is very messy. And that's what people don't want to have. It's like most of us don't like hard conversations, right? Frankly, I think only crazy people do. I don't like to be on the delivery or the receiving end. And what I see all over the place is in avoiding discomfort and hard conversations, we create a lot more suffering. For example, I look at one of the classic things that happens in a lot of business circumstances and settings is what they call the PIP, the Performance Improvement Plan. And the Performance Improvement Plan, in my experience, as a therapist, as a human, as a friend, I have a husband who works at the university, I hear about these all over town. And what I often hear are these things. We waited until this person was almost sinking at their job to give them the Performance Improvement Plan. Part two, the Performance Improvement Plan is so vague, they couldn't possibly succeed. It says things like, you need to have better communication. What does that even mean? You should talk more, you should talk less, you should talk in Japanese. And then the last part is, nobody was courageous enough to say something like, Joe, every time we get on a Zoom call, I feel you interrupt and disrupt and want to have your way. And I think that's really getting in the way of our meeting. And I'd like to be at cause to see what's behind that and see if we could help you be as successful as you want to be. That's courageous leadership, because that actually is calling Joe up and in rather than giving him some BS plan behind his back that he can't be successful around when we're basically plotting to fire him, or we hire someone else to do his job and don't tell him, or we all just complain about him behind his back. And this happens in families and it happens in businesses, because if you get it, businesses are just families that don't sleep in the same bed at night. We're all bringing the same stuff. We have these relationships, and whatever skill level we're lacking in relationships at home, we are likely lacking them even more so at work, because there's a higher level of risk there. Because if we don't belong at work, we're unemployed and we may not be able to pay our rent or our mortgage.
Can you imagine if we learned as children to check in with ourselves, to emotionally regulate and communicate from that place?
I actually do imagine it all the time. I have five children. And I was very late to the game and really embodying this myself. So I'm madly working to catch up with them. And it's the same thing I'm doing with leaders as adults, which is the way we will teach children to do this is model it as adults. If the whole world as adults were having these hard conversations, then children would have models all over the place. Instead, what they have models for is gossip and aggression and avoidance and people being frozen.
And in your leadership skills, you talk about bringing together language, action, feeling, and meaning to create the foundation for leading with potency and power. How do you, other than modeling for your kids, how do you do that for your kids? And how are they doing?
So I think the model, the first thing I learned was to be able to say I needed a timeout. And my children just thought that was the most amazing, hilarious, shocking thing, because we live in a world where grownups give kids timeouts, but grownups don't give grownups timeouts. So I started to take timeouts. And what I realized was it was needed. I needed to be able to step back and take a few breaths and have perspective, because in that moment, I had none. And so in that moment, what I also was trying to land for them that I didn't even realize until years later is that when we get dysregulated, when things feel uncomfortable, our first default is often to make something or someone wrong. Our child's not behaving right. We're not parenting right. The weather that's not right. Our boss isn't right. The book's not right. The instructions were wrong. We like to make something wrong rather than actually just pause and say, what if I didn't make anyone wrong and I could actually see how do I want to move this forward? So now I'm not caught in a story. I'm not caught in building a case or gathering evidence. I'm not going backwards. I'm actually pausing in the present moment, connecting to myself, knowing myself so that I can see where it gets sticky for me and I can go forward. that's just an example, I think, of how when my kids were smaller, I used to model that for them. And then as they got older and their development and maturation continued along the path, we often would say at night around the dinner table, like, where did you really screw up the most today? Did you really feel unloved today? We just started to have uncomfortable, hard conversations where their dad and I were right there in it with them. So they didn't feel weird or different. Now, again, you take this in a business setting and what you see is the boss comes down and says, hey, everybody, I want us to be vulnerable and share our real stuff. You guys go first.
You're like, uh-oh.
Yeah, it has to start at the top, right? Whoever has the place of power are the ones that need to be modeling it. And so my kids are as human and flawed as I am. And what I love is seeing how capable they are to own their flaws, to lead with their flaws and not see themselves as flawed. I guess they have flaws, but they don't see themselves as flawed. And that's probably my biggest joy for them.
That's back to what you were saying about having compassion for yourself and understanding that we're all human. I mean, when you talk about being human, many people don't really understand what that means. It almost feels like it's a code language that we have, but that's true. It's like we all make mistakes. We all screw up. In the program, you teach leadership skills, of course. And two of the things that I thought were really interesting that seem somewhat intuitive, but in real life, as a real human being, not so intuitive. And that is to become a more thoughtful listener and creative problem solver. And I would love to hear some really practical tools for becoming better at both of those.
Sure. So like everything else that gets taught in the Humility First training, it starts with you. So one of the things that I give people as I give this as an assignment to anyone actually who wants an assignment from me, which is I ask people before their feet hit the ground in the morning to put both their hands on their bodies and say, who's in there? What do they need? What do they want? So part of why we're not thoughtful listeners is most of our orientation psychologically is to be liked, to be picked, to be chosen, to be right. And we spend all of our time trying to do that from the moment our brain alerts us that we're awake, even before our eyes open, all the way until we lay down to go to sleep. And sometimes we can't sleep because we're still working that out in our heads. And to me, thoughtful listening comes first from being a thoughtful listener to yourself. And to start to ask yourself, who's in there? Maybe it's someone who like didn't sleep well last night. So the starting place is, so I'm going to need some compassion. Maybe it's something simple like who's in there is someone who hasn't been drinking enough water and I can feel it today and I have low energy and I'm going to really commit to doing that. Someone who's in there feels really tender because of this thing happening with my family and I need to reach out for support. Learning to check in and tune into ourselves culturally is called selfish. And my experience is the people who practice the most self-care are the least draw on the planet and actually have the most to offer. So to be a thoughtful listener is to first learn to thoughtfully listen to yourself without judgment, reaction, and waiting for your turn to talk. Now, from that thoughtful listening comes creative problem solving, because as we start to become more quiet, more curious, more aware, we have all this information available to us. But if, again, we're oriented to being right, to belonging, to being picked, to being chosen, to being told we're good enough, it's hard to be creative because it's our ego that's stumping to be chosen, not our most creative, expansive possibility side.
And how do these tools influence the overall company culture? And in that, you talk a lot about creating connection and community within the organization. What have you seen in terms of how a company's culture has dramatically changed from these tools and skills?
So as I listen to the 40 plus leaders that have graduated with my training in the last few years, I hear things like, in corporations, we have so much coming at us all day long and we're expected to be quick and reactive and good problem solvers and good listeners and provide feedback and empower our team. And that this training keeps reminding me that by being present, balanced, and vulnerable as a leader, I get to lead with my authentic voice. I'm more calm, I'm curious, I'm clear, and that my team feels seen and known. And from my experience, Patricia, on this planet for 52-ish years, and as a therapist and a mom and all the roles I've played, I believe that what we are here for is to be seen and known. And I think about my husband owned a civil engineer company in Denver for years, and we started this little Friday meet the boss, and he would go out onto these job sites where they were building and doing all kinds of stuff. And he would always bring coffee and donuts or bagels or something. And what he couldn't believe was that a $2 cup of coffee and bagel and cream cheese and a 10-minute conversation with someone, he felt bought him this absolute commitment. They gave him this absolute desire to give him everything they had because they felt seen. Mm. And why not to blow my mind that it is the simplest thing we can do to see people. When you open the door for someone at the grocery store, see them and do it. Flirt with old people, compliment people's young children, smile at people when you pass them. That when you are leading in a company, to ask people about who they are besides their work world and besides if they have solved this problem or dilemma, to have this openness and curiosity with other human beings allows them to feel valued, allows them to find their place. And I find that that capacity of connecting us to ourselves and to other humans helps people to feel this level of love for their team, for their boss. They feel pride in their work. And the exact opposite is shown in all of the data, which is when people don't feel seen or valued at work, they are unhappy, they are burnt out, they become unhappy and not good employees to have for us, and it is how the company eventually burns down.
Your husband was very lucky to have an in-house advisor.
He's equally my advisor on different things.
That's how it goes, right? Diversity of skill sets.
That's right.
You also share about finding your own blind spots, and this sounds a little bit more like therapy. But in your training program and also in the work that you do in corporations, what are some tools that help people to identify their own blind spots and to be more courageous?
You got it. So we have a whole week on fear to courage, because what I say to people is your blind spot is probably something you're already aware of. And again, sure, I talk about this in therapy, but I also would say this is very human work, which is, let's say you've got an employee at your company who is truly unaware that they keep hijacking the meeting. They just doing it over and over. And you have this sense they don't necessarily mean to, they're really wanting to help, but they're not letting anyone else share the space or get a word in edgewise. So one of the things we talk about is calling others or ourselves in and up to our best place, which means we assume the best. It means we reflect something with curiosity. Like, I don't know, John, but my sense of this is, my experience of this is, what do you think? And then there's no shaming or blaming, right? To call someone out is to expose and humiliate them. And this whole year of the leadership training, one of the things we do ad nauseum is we work on feedback. And I give them so many things that I've built into the curriculum for them to experience that. Because for most of us, feedback, personally and professionally, was one of two things. It was either evisceration or having smoke blowing up our backside. Those things are very helpful feedback. When you're teaching anything and someone says that was great, I would tell you that means nothing. It tells me nothing. So we need to learn how to give feedback, how to try on feedback. And so this place of really showing up and being fully human is about learning the skill set of what are these places in me that I don't want to see. And instead of hiding from them, how can I bring them out into the open and learn to celebrate them in the feedback process? And another way I might say this is, it's been my experience personally and professionally that people who eventually come to understand they have an alcohol problem, for example, they knew the entire time they did, but learn to separate themselves from it. So to be brave is to what we call smoke ourselves out of the cave, is to say, I already see some of these places in me. It's just that because I think being human means I'm supposed to be better and perfect and lovable and not have these things, I don't like to see them. So by developing this compassionate relationship with yourself, you get more willing and more skilled to go looking for who you really are and to celebrate it all. And if change is something you choose, it doesn't come from shame or aggressive self-improvement. It comes from self-compassion.
this is what you discussed too about clarity and radical truth telling and noticing patterns and moving towards yourself. I just read this quote, when you pause in the middle of a autopilot habit, ask yourself this question, if I strengthen this habit, will it bring suffering or relief? I feel like that's such a simple but profound question to ask yourself as you're about to move more towards yourself and who you are as a holistic human being.
It's brilliant. And I would say a way to drop that into your body and embody it is, instead of all those words or that question, what you might also say is, what I'm about to do going to allow my nervous system to regulate and lead the nervous systems for those in the room around me? Or is what I'm about to do going to dysregulate my nervous system?
Yes. And you also talk about using science to lead ourselves and others. And I would love for you to share a little bit about some of the neuroscience or data that you've got that supports a lot of this work.
First of all, it's so great that we all have these different skill sets. And I was never going to be a researcher. I think I failed statistics at least twice, if not three times. So luckily for me, there are these amazing people out there who are collecting fabulous information about our brains and our bodies and how they work. And I feel so lucky to be on the planet at this time where in the last 20 years, we are getting data in all different directions that help us to look at the state that we're in when we learn something creates a physical response, creates neural pathways. We have data that shows the more self-compassionate we are, the more we can lower our heart rate. We have data to show that giving ourselves time and mindfulness and meditation practice can actually strengthen and lengthen our telomeres, the strands at the end of our DNA. With all of this science, again, I try to make it very approachable to my students, which is for those who like to geek out on it, which is definitely a big chunk. We give them all kinds of literature review to fall down the rabbit hole with. But during our sessions on the weekend, what we're really looking at is how the science shows each one of us that what we know now, and I think it's Stanford that's just produced this great study. Sometimes it makes me laugh that we have to study these things, but they said, guess what? The best leaders are the most self-aware.
Right. Okay.
And yeah, I love to study these things, and sometimes it's a little bit maddening. But I think what I love about that the most is that's not the mindset of most corporations and companies. Most companies treat humans as, on some level, robots, and they expect them to separate and leave out the parts behind that are intrusive or quote unquote too personal. And I think, again, what I would much prefer companies do is give their leaders the skill set to hold themselves and hold others, which is to learn the capacity and skill to check in with yourself, to check in with others, and keep moving the work along.
My name is Dwayne Osterlin. I'm host of the Addicted Mind podcast. Are you ready to uncover the science of breaking addiction? Then join me on the Addicted Mind, where compassion meets innovation. We're going to explore real stories of addiction recovery, hear from real experts on science-based treatment, and you'll be able to equip yourself with the tools for lasting change. So whether you're on the road to recovery yourself or walking alongside someone who is, the Addicted Mind podcast is your companion. So check it out. Subscribe on whatever podcast app you're using right now and be part of the conversation that's changing lives.
I feel like there's just so much. This is why when you and I speak, when we're having coffee, we go off in so many different directions, because there's everything is just so rich. And I am very curious what your personal practice is daily. So I know you're a brilliant teacher and therapist, and you do so many of these things for other people. But what do you do for yourself every day?
So the first practice I do is the one I recommend for everyone, which is I put my hands in my body and I check in. And that helps me just, again, set myself up nutritionally for more or less movement, for maybe I need to make or break a social plan. It helps me stay in alignment with whatever the day is ahead before I get off and running to meet all of these asks and requests from the world towards myself. I also always have a commitment of what I call my moving towards myself practice. When I was a new practitioner, I had what I would call a strict or rigid practice. I used to have my 5-5-5 practice, which is what I would move for 5 minutes. I would meditate for 5 minutes and I would journal for 5 minutes. And for years, when I had four small children at the time, it was about all I felt I could fit in. I certainly did a lot of yoga and meditation, but it wasn't any more regular than my 5-5-5. And now that I've been a long-term mindfulness and spiritual practitioner, I would say really the practice is moving towards myself and checking in. And it's that checking of, do I need to go to the gym and lift heavy weights today? Do I need to sit in meditation for a half an hour? Do I need to check in on my neighbor who's sick? Like, as I move towards myself, and again, what's going to allow my nervous system to really regulate? What will that be? And I think for people who are new to spiritual practices, I recommend finding whatever lights up you internally, right? It could be a book, it could be a teacher, it could be a class, and make that regular, make that time regular, make that practice regular. So as it starts to get more embodied, you've got a chance of getting some success of continuing with it. And then I think as we all start to practice more, we realize it's not the practices that are magic, it's that they put us into our own experience. And what I mean by that is, one of the sessions this winter, my leadership trainees were almost like confessing, like, I haven't been so good about my meditation. I haven't gotten on my mat to my yoga, and I've been skipping those things. And I said, pause. It's not the practices you're missing. It's you that you're missing. When you don't get on your mat, you miss connecting to you. When you don't meditate, you miss connecting to you. So don't make them about the practices. There's no right or wrong, good or bad practices. But what there is, are many, many opportunities to connect with you. And that's what the practices to me are really about. That's what's behind them.
Yeah, that is such great wisdom, because I think there are people that don't practice meditation or mindfulness or yoga, but maybe they play the piano or the violin or the cello, or they do marathons, or there are other practices that they do where they have learned to connect with themselves. And that can be very beautiful as well. Is there anything else that you want to share about the Humanity First program? Because I'd love to move into one of my favorite topics with you, relationships. But I want to close out on the Humanity First program.
Yeah, I think to me, again, I would just say that we all have the opportunity to be an example or a warning. We're all leading, whether we know it or not, and to lead yourself first with more grace and beauty and self-compassion will without a doubt inevitably help you be at cause to be an amazing leader everywhere you are on the planet. So I'm not sure why anybody wouldn't want that.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. And I think that so elegantly moves us into a discussion about our personal relationships, because there are so many similarities being a leader in our own lives, in our work, in our relationships. In our previous discussion, you talked about knowing ourselves, knowing others, learning that different qualities mean that we have to learn to mitigate and move our dials both separately and together to create symphony and harmony. Mm-hmm. Can you share a little bit more about that and what makes in your work as a therapist, but also as a partner, what makes a relationship sing?
Yeah, that's a great question. Boy, if we can solve that, we're going to really like this interview. So years ago, I read, some people know Debbie Ford. She's no longer with us, but I used to think of her as the Cliff Notes of Deepak Chopra. And she wrote a book called The Dark Side of the Light Chasers. And I was reading that book and I was like, oh yeah, there's this part of us that in seeking, we want to keep shoving down and away these dark things. And what I realized in reading that book is that all of my personality traits I had on like a light switch. It was either on or off. Go back to my initial story of feeling like I was too much. I was either too much, or if I shut it off, I felt like I was not enough. And it was just simply very rudimentary and primitive, and it was on and off. And what I realized in reading that book, and I can't recall what connected for me, but something where I realized, oh, I would like to picture like a volume dialer. Now I'd secretly love to be a DJ and make great playlists for yoga classes. So I picture this big soundboard that has all my personality traits on it. And then it's up to me to be intentional and conscious to move those dials to work best for the situation. So as you link it back to your question about relationship, there's a part of me that takes up a lot of space. I have a lot to share. I get excited. I love being silly. I love talking about political ideas. And I, as you can hear in this podcast, could talk and talk and talk. Married to an engineer who's more quiet and more reserved. And for a long time, I think we were both comfortable with him being quieter and me being louder. And over time, what I realized was that wasn't actually so satisfying for me. That was an easy default for me. There was nothing wrong with being talkative. And I wanted to have more skill to make more space and request my partner to move towards me and meet me. So what you can hear in that is, I didn't make my qualities wrong. I didn't make him's qualities wrong. I didn't say, gosh, Taylor, what the heck's wrong with you? You're talking all the time. I didn't say to him, what the heck's wrong with you? You're not talking enough. I just said, what would be more satisfying to my nervous system and my joy in this relationship is if I left you more room, because I take up a lot of space and I'm well aware of that and I'm at cause for that. And I'm going to really work on that and invite you to, with love, feedback me on that. And I think one of the basic relationship premises is this next one I'm about to say, which is always requests rather than complaints, because complaints are aggressive and requests are vulnerable. So then what I said to him is, and my request is that you rise up and move forward and meet me. And that's going to be challenging for both of us. And so let's do it together. We're back to this place I was saying before about the Humanity First training is often when things are uncomfortable, like when I realized I wasn't as satisfied, my mind at first was like, oh, Taylor, you're wrong. Or he's wrong for not speaking. It was like somebody had to be wrong. And then it was like, wait a minute, nobody's wrong. This is what I can own and be at cause at. This is the request I have of him. So let's be a we and be in it together and be uncomfortable and grow together.
So you're generally talkative and rich with wisdom, and he's quiet. And in encouraging him kindly to share more or be more equal in the conversation, and maybe that's not even the right way to say it, but how does that process happen? Because in my mind, that's inviting someone to change when they may not want to change, or it may not be natural for them. They may be comfortable with their quiet. And I'm wondering if there is this period where you, as someone who's rich with dialogue, lets things just sit in silence. And if that's possible, are you comfortable with that?
Yeah. So I think it looks like a lot of things. I think hopefully it looks like intimate, possibly hard conversation with your partner, which is first asking them, like, is that something that would be more satisfying to you? And luckily for me, my husband said, actually, I'd love to take up more space. I was like, fantastic. So we were off to a good start there.
Good, good.
And then what I would say is we fumbled through, right? Like I went back at times to my old ways of talking too much, and he got really brave and was like, hey, can you pause for a minute? I feel like this is a place I'd like to speak up. And I was like, fantastic. Other questions, I'd say, hey, I haven't heard from you a while and I'd love to hear your thoughts on X. And I'd ask a pointed question. Sometimes he could meet me there. Sometimes he couldn't. And I think, again, like anything, sometimes it was incredibly frustrating and sometimes it was incredibly satisfying and everything in between, which is all the tenets of relationship in general, right? I think it's the willingness to be messy and fumble. It's the willingness and desire to create a we. That I say to couples, like their very first session, I see a lot of couples in my office, and I say to them in the very first session, like there's some basic things you'll have to agree to if you want to come back and work with me. And if not, that's no problem. We can refer you out. But I say, you need to be more committed to being connected than being right. That's the first thing. The next is there has to be a foundation in this relationship where we can assume the best of each other. So when someone forgets to pick up bread at the grocery store or shows up late, we're not already like, got hands around a throat reacting, but we're saying, oh gosh, I'm guessing you got hung up or you forgot because you're human. So there's that piece that we assume the best. And the last piece is that we are 110% willing to be in this relationship until we're not. And what I mean by that is this, I've had the incredible honor of officiating maybe a dozen weddings, really fun, really beautiful thing to do. And one of the things that I have each time found a different opportunity and way to share is that oftentimes at things like vows in these moments, people say, I'm going to love you, da 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 da, till death do us part. And what I say is, what we really mean is, or until you frustrate me, disappoint me, I'm vulnerable, in which case I'm going to get aggressive or avoid you. Or like, so what I remind people on that day, and I talk to couples about a lot, is if you're ready to pack up your bags, that's okay. Give yourself permission to pack up and go. But if you're not, you may not sit on the fence and lob complaints and throw bombs over and gripe and gossip and moan and cross your arms and wait for someone else to do the work. You must courageously, vulnerably get 110% into the water. Now, I don't know if that means you're going to get clear 2 weeks later, as some couples do. You know what? Once you asked us to get in, I realized I was already out. I'm done. Great. some couples, what really a lot of us want to do is I'm going to sit back because I've decided here's what you need to work on and here's what you need to do. And I'm going to stay in this really comfortable side of the fence until you do it, until you behave the way I want. Basically, we don't like to get messy and vulnerable and risk. And that is required if we're going to stay connected.
I guess the question always comes up with couples that have this willingness. How do you let go of grudges? Or
yeah, I think grudges is that we don't have the skill to clear things, right? So grudges are the word to say complaint. And a complaint is protective. It's my entitled righteous seat that you got it wrong and you screwed up. And let's take one of the ultimate grudges that shows up in the partnership, infidelity, emotional or physical. Infidelity is really simply that somebody felt too cowardly to keep trying to have a conversation with you and they wanted to find love and belonging. And so it's all around them. So they just jumped out to find it somewhere else. Because the truth is, we will say and do anything with strangers because we're never going to see them again. But that person you have to work things out with and wake up with day after day after day, that is the most difficult thing. And I think there's a wonderful quote, and I think it says, if you want endless repetition, date a lot of people. If you want infinite variety, stay with one. I think it's actually Joni Mitchell. And she talks about this great idea of like, when you date, you run all your best moves and tell all your best story, and you get to fall in love with yourself over and over again. But with a longtime person, they know all your crap. And that's part of what we're terrified of, is the longer we're in it, the more invested we are, the more we stand to lose. And it terrifies us.
Yeah. One of my friends the other day said that he's been married for, I think it's 32 years. And he said he still feels like he doesn't know his wife. And that's what he loves best about her, that there's that curiosity and that he'll ask questions. And you don't assume, because I think when people are married for a really long time, you're assuming you know someone so well that you may not ask how they feel or what they're thinking.
And of course, it's also just safer to make judgments, right? Like if I just decide my husband's going to be quiet and not talk, and then I get to make up a story and I get to be right and I get to play it out, but I also get to stay unsatisfied. So if I get courageous and say, hey, I know this isn't what we signed up for, but something's changed for me and I'm not as satisfied. And I'm wondering if we could negotiate and work that out. Ooh, that's scary.
Scary to say that out loud. I'm not as satisfied anymore.
Yeah. And at the same time, I can think of three very specific times I came home and like marched my husband to the front porch and had that conversation. And I was not super skillful because I was so terrified. It felt a little bit like a rocket launching out of my chest. But I would say the richest times in our relationship have come from those conversations, because then he got courageous enough to ask hard questions, also share hard things. And all of a sudden we're in it again. And the aliveness of that relationship went through the ceiling. And that's really what I wanted, was aliveness. And that's what I think most of us want, is to be seen and feel aliveness. And if there's a lack of aliveness, there is usually unspoken truth. Mark Nepo, my favorite poet of all times, I have a quote over my desk. I'm looking at it right now, and it says, to voice things as they are is the nearest medicine.
It's one thing to have these conversations, and then it's another to actually be brave enough. Like you were saying, you were super nervous to say that to your husband. Often people, they've grown differently along the spectrum of self-awareness, and that can make it even more difficult. Like when you were saying your husband was more quiet, maybe earlier in your relationship, you would try to explain something and he might look at you befuddled with what you're saying. And as you grow together, he has learned more about the Taylor language and some of these psychological and relationship skills. Would you say that's true?
I think it's true. I think the other piece that's really even bigger, Patricia, is he was really feeling like, I'm terrified to grow beyond my own dynamics and understanding of myself and the world I came from in my family, but you seem so willing. I'm the Labrador retriever in my household. I like to bound to the door and have it be completely known how much I love you and I'm here. And so I think my work was to be non-judgmental and create as courageous and safe a space as possible to say, hey, it's totally okay. You're not skilled around this. And we probably will need to work on it if we're going to stay together. And if you don't want to, that would be a bummer, but I could accept that. But if you want to, I think we could have something amazing. And I think that really inspired some hope for him. And he got super courageous and stays in that place where he's really willing. And I think in my heart, I believe that's what all of us want. Mm-hmm. And also terrified, because love and belonging is our most important psychological need. it is perceived as a threat constantly to us, both in friendships and deep love relationships. And so a lot of people just give up and they get off in their apartment with plastic over all their furniture and 10 cats. And they're like, oh, that's it. And I get that. And most of us very much want to be known and seen and loved and have the same with someone else in return. And so I'm going to encourage people to keep getting courageous and moving towards themselves and other humans, because I actually think if you really think about it, everybody wants to be loved. Everybody wants to feel chosen and connected. And everyone is so, so, so scared. And I just read a great poem in yoga that somebody shared with me the other day that I love, that said, you know, that person across from me that's so intimidating and scary, they're 65% water like you too.
You also talk a lot about your superpower and your kryptonite. And a lot of people appear in their superpower when they're out in the world, but that can also be kryptonite inside of a relationship. What's the balance of superpower and kryptonite in a relationship?
Yeah, I would say there's no balance. They're just knowing that very likely they lie on the same continuum, right? So like my too muchness and my not enoughness lie in the same continuum, meaning I can be really outgoing and that can be really inviting at times and it can be really smothering at times. So being mindful that that doesn't make me or that quality wrong. It just means I was a little bit more fumbly with it than I would have liked to be. But as we learn to embrace our kryptonite, we embrace our humanity, which is nobody is good at everything. Nobody has it all figured out. Nobody rides free. Ram Dass couldn't have been more spot on when he said, we're all just going to walk each other home. As we really put our arms around ourselves and say, oh gosh, dear, look at this little glitch you keep carrying around. Isn't that amusing? And we can hold ourselves with more lightness. Mm-hmm. Sylvia Boorstein was such a guide for me around that. She used to talk about the story of she went to the airport and every time they'd come over the intercom and they'd say the same old thing, don't leave your bags watched. And she said she dropped to the floor in a panic and her family would say, what the heck is wrong with you? She learned to just put her hands on her heart and say, oh, sweetheart, there's that little glitch you have. Isn't that amusing? And to be amused by your frailties, your kryptonites, your shortcomings is to celebrate your full humanity. And I think that's just such a more beautiful path for all of us. And I find the compassion and understanding that brings to both my intimate relationships and strangers is endless.
Yeah. And it's nice to model the value of us as human beings vulnerably bringing our little messy hearts together. And as you say, rubbing them up against each other and being comfortable with that. And I love what you said about Ram Dass. We're all here to walk each other home.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think that really to me is when I get ahead of myself or overwhelmed in the day, that's what I try to come back with is like, how am I going to walk myself and anybody else around me home today? Because let's not make it too much more complicated than that.
Do you ever have moments where you don't trust your intuition, or have you just become so comfortable in your own skin now?
Oh, that's so interesting. I trust my intuition, but my mentor this morning asked me a great, great question along those lines. And she said, what I want you to be so curious about, Taylor, like the question to be asking yourself is, what's the next level of not knowing look and feel like? I think because I am really connected to my intuition and I have a lot running through my mind that I'm not even trying to figure out, it's just the way my mind works. I think getting curious about what it means to not know and what it means to be in uncertainty and how to have even more awareness and compassion for that. Because I would say for me, I trust my intuition. However, that doesn't always mean I act on it, meaning I often feel in my intuition, I need to have that hard conversation. And then sometimes I'm as chicken as everybody else. I'm like, I think I'll just put that off. So listening to your intuition and acting on it are two different things. And the acting is everything. Otherwise, it's just a whole lot of motion and words. So I would say I'm as humbled as everyone else is when it comes to acting on it. My intuition is often my biggest cheerleader. It probably is my biggest cheerleader next to my husband, but it wants me to do scary things. Like it wanted me to create a leadership training and it wanted me to create more children and take trips and get me out of my comfort zone. And while it inspires me and it absolutely conspires for my greatness, it scares the living daylights out of me sometimes. So I listen to it and I trust it. However, I sometimes hide from it and try to throw a wet blanket over it so it'll go away for a little while.
Well, like you always say to me, sometimes you just need to rest.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes I say, you know, today's not looking good, tomorrow neither, but I'll come back for you at some point here.
I am always so blown away at the buckets full of wisdom that come forth from you. I feel like you're a fountain sometimes. I could sit and listen to you for hours.
Thank you for saying that, Patricia, because the other metaphor I get is people often say to me, being with you is like drinking from the fire hose, which brings up all my too muchness, Patricia. So thanks for the fountain, because I'm going to use that as a really nice way to love myself a little more.
The fountain is much, much nicer than the fire hose.
Yeah.
So beautiful. Is there anything else you want to share? Do you have another favorite quote or poem that you love that you want to share with us before we close?
I think that if you don't own a copy of anything Mark Nepo wrote, I want to tell everyone to go and get it. And I think one of the things, again, I love is he speaks so much about truth, which as someone who lived outside her truth for so long, to reclaim my truth has been so healing. But this passage on my board says, what is most healing about bearing witness to things exactly as they are is that when the voice of the pain fits the pain, there's no room for distortion or illusion. And in this way, truth becomes a clean bandage that heals, keeping dirt out of the wound. And I would say that what has saved and repaired and healed most days of my life, and really the only thing I'm ever offering to any other person, is to try to give them the courage and the vision that their truth lives in each one of them and each one of all of us. And that the more we can voice things as they are, we get this medicine, we have a clean bandage that makes our life feel so much more potent and powerful. And it allows us to be at peace and ease, not to be confused with the happiness so many of us strive for, but that when hard things happen, if we can feel calm and at ease and at peace, there is something so satisfying about that. And it's not elusive. It's not far from us. It really starts with this place of being able to say what's true and let that truth do the work for you. And it's very scary and very challenging and the most satisfying work I think most of us will do in this lifetime, certainly for me.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I think our audience is up for that. Taylor, it is, as always, such a pleasure to have a conversation with you and to be with you on Untangle. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much to Taylor for joining us today. And she's a fountain of wisdom for sure. For more on her program, check out humanityshared.com. And if you want to check out Muse, go to choosemuse.com. And to share suggestions or feedback, email us at untangle@choosemuse.com. Loved having you with us today. As always, have a great week, and we will see you next time.